This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest things that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, nor despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to fixed views, the pure heart of one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
Okay, so I'm going to now say a few words, and then we'll do some meditation together. That sound good?
Yep.
Okay, so. Since we were talking a bit earlier about my translation work and so on, I thought I might just say a few words about that, if that's okay.
I don't think we can hear you in the
cheap seats. Is that all right? In the cheap seats? Well, no one cares about the people in the cheap seats. That's why they're cheap. Should I speak? Is that better? All right, sorry. So forgive me. I've been staying on an island for 2.5 years with no one to talk to but myself. And so usually I don't have any problem hearing myself, so that's good. So I forget about these things, like public speaking. Anyway, so, yes. We just recited the Metta Sutta, okay? The Buddha's words on loving kindness, right? Yes? No. Not the Buddha's words on loving kindness. That'd be ridiculous. The Buddha didn't speak English. Right?
Yes.
Yeah? Whose words are they on loving kindness?
Translation.
By who?
Us, monks.
Yeah. That's kind of vague, isn't it?
Scientists. What do you call
scientists?
Them? No, what do you call them? Linguists.
Linguists. Ah, okay. Yeah. Linguists.
Linguists.
Fortunately, no. No, linguists are usually terrible translators. Actually, it's a translation that was made by a. Group of people at Amarawati Monastery, English Monastery, in about, it would have been in the early 1990s, and among whom were, I think Ajahn Suchito, and I think one or two others, they sort of collaborated on it. I'm not 100% sure of that. And I just mentioned this because, well, you probably had never thought of that before, right? That we have this translation. It comes from like a particular person at a particular place and particular time who has interpreted their understanding of the Buddha's words and tried to express that as well as they can in English. Now, this particular sutta, the Metta Sutta, is obviously very beautiful words and very inspiring and one of the most translated texts. So I run a website called Sutta Central, and what we do is we gather the translations of Buddhist texts, many, 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 many of them, and the original texts and the translations, and we try to make them available to people. And this particular text, the Metta Sutta, is an interesting one because we recently, a friend of ours, an Egyptian monk in Sri Lanka, recently translated it into Arabic. And so we now have that on our website. So we believe the first published Arabic translation of a Buddhist sutta in modern times. And also, for the geeks among you, it has also been translated into Sindarin, the language of the elves from The Lord of the Rings.
That'd be funny.
What about Klingon?
I said Klingon. I said you have to, because they like really need some meta, right? They tend to be a bit kind of, you know, they could really do with a bit of that, yeah? So we are looking out for a Klingon translation. If there are any Klingon experts here, then please get in touch and we will do that, yes. So we've now translated it into Elvish, so that's good. Any elves who want to read that? So, you know, obviously that's just a bit of fun, but the idea is that the Buddha's words should be available for people to read, to understand, and to learn from in their own language. And when the Buddha spoke to people, he spoke in an ordinary language. He spoke to ordinary people. He didn't just speak to experts, he didn't just speak to linguists and philosophers, he spoke to farmers, and he spoke to workers, and he spoke to wives bringing up kids in the home, and all different kinds of people. And he would always teach in a way that would reach out to and address the problems that person had, and try to bring them happiness. He wasn't the slightest bit concerned with trying to convert people, with trying to convince them, with trying to impose his own teaching or understanding on people. He was interested to listen to them and to learn what is actually bringing the suffering, what is bringing happiness, and to try to help them to let go of the suffering and to cultivate their happiness. And so this is a theme that we find again and again in the Buddhist scriptures. Now, in modern times, the Buddhist texts have been translated into various languages. The original texts, of course, are in Pali. Anybody here speak Pali? No? No? What was the name of the sutta we just chanted?
Metta Sutta.
See, that's Pali? So you speak Pali? Yeah? If you can say Metta Sutta, you can say Pali. So that's a start, anyway. Alright? That's not too bad. Right. So actually we use a lot of words from Pali. Pali is very similar to Sanskrit, and we use a lot of words from Pali or Sanskrit in Buddhist circles. Like Buddha is a Pali word, or Dharma and Nibbana and these kinds of things. So you'll sort of pick up a few of the words from those languages, but most people, of course, don't really they're not really fluent in those languages. Other texts are not in Pali, they might be in Sanskrit. Others are in Tibetan. A lot of ancient Buddhist texts are in Chinese. But the Chinese that's used for those texts is a very archaic form of Chinese, right? So it's, for a modern Chinese person to read it, it's like if we were to read Chaucer or something like that, right? That we can recognize that it's English, but it's pretty hard to sort of, you know, you need to study it before you can really figure out what's going on. So a lot of these original texts are not very accessible to people. They're not very available. And so various people have tried to translate them into modern languages. And on the website I've been working on for many years in Sutta Central, we've gathered those together and try to organize them and so on. And there's a number of interesting things that I've learned from doing this process. One interesting thing is that almost all of the translations of Buddhist scriptures are done by amateurs. they're almost all done by people like you, who think, hey, we should have some translations and just sit down and do them. They're not done by experts in a university. They're not done by big monasteries or by committees or by institutes or anything like that. They're not done by people who have money and funds and expertise and training. They're just done by people who have a love of the Dhamma and who want to try to make that Dhamma available to people in their own language. Now, that's not always true. There are some cases where things have been done by professionals and experts, committees, universities, but that's very much a minority. So what tends to happen is that people will try to say, okay, I want to translate some texts and so on, and then they have to translate them, but then they have to not only figure out what they mean, figure out how to translate them, but then they have to figure out how to publish them, right, make a website, put them in a book, and these kinds of things. So it's a lot of work. So what we want to try to do is to make that a lot easier for them. And one of the things that I noticed was that in Buddhism, we didn't really have, like even the main scriptures that we have, the main sets of suttas that we have, we didn't really have a good version of those that were freely available. So we have some translations that are not particularly good, other translations that are good, but they're not freely available. But we didn't have any sets that are good and freely available. So this is why I set out to do this translation project. So the texts I translated are called the four Nikayas: Digha Nikaya, Madhyama Nikaya, Samyutta Nikaya, and Anguttara Nikaya. And these are the four. Excuse me, I've been a bit of a chest for the last few days. But the and these four Nikayas in Pali are really the kind of the core, the heart of the early Buddhist texts and the heart of the teachings that come from the Buddha himself. And they have been translated before, but as I said, we don't have a free and good quality translation available for them. So I decided, okay, well, we've got to get this translation available. How are we going to do it? And so I went through all of these different scenarios about how we're going to get this done. And then I realized at the end of the day, I'm just going to have to do it myself.
Good on you.
Yeah. So that's what I did. And I was very lucky because I was at a point in my life where I had been studying and practicing Dhamma for long enough that I had a reasonable, you know, body of knowledge of how to do this. But also, I mentioned before, and we're on the way here, about how I had quit my philosophy degree to go and play rock and roll. So I haven't become any more responsible in the years since then. So I was equally able to quit all of my responsibilities since that time and go off and stay on an island by myself without feeling guilty about it. So that was also something that was very lucky. See, this is the problem, right? So something like Pali, it takes a long time. It's not just learning a language, but you really have to learn the Dhamma, and you have to absorb it, and you have to practice it, and you have to live with other people who are practicing it and absorbing it, and discuss it with them, and you have to do that for a long period of time before you have the maturity to be able to really express it well. Right? So there's not many people who can do that, and usually by the time somebody who is able to do that, then, you know, they're like Ajahn Brahm or someone, you know, they're running a monastery and they're looking after people and they have responsibilities. And so this is one of the reasons why it's really difficult to actually get some of this work done. So I was in a very fortunate situation that I could do this work and I could be supported to stay alone and do the work. And I have some supporters in Malaysia, and their family had their roots on this little island called Chimei, which is halfway between Taiwan and China. And they'd grown up, their family had settled on that island about 100 years ago, and they'd grown up. It was just a little fishing village and so on there. And they'd all the family had left and so on, but they still had a little home there. So they were quite happy to put me up there and to support me to stay for 2.5 years. Mm. So that's what I did. I just got up and did my translation. And, you know, I was there by myself so I could do my practice and the solitude. But people say, how can you do that? Obviously, the hard part is not doing it, right? The hard part is not doing everything else. Right? You won't be able to achieve anything. The hard part is not doing the thing, it's not doing everything else. Yeah? And so you have to make that decision. All of those other things, like coming to Armidale, right? I had to let go of coming to Armidale. Yeah?
Oh, devastating.
I know, right? I know. Thank you. Yeah. And so many other things, right, that I had to let go of. And, you know, it's just, I really am grateful and very, very appreciative of the kindness of all of my friends and, you know, people who have been my students and so on have showed to support me to do that, because otherwise it really just wouldn't have been possible. So I stayed there for 2 years. It's weird, 2.5 years staying there, not talking to anyone. Like everyone, strangely enough, everyone there speaks Chinese. Who knew, right? Nobody speaks Pali, and nobody speaks English either. So I didn't have anyone to talk to, so that was fine. And it's, I don't know if you've ever spent a long time not talking, but it's weird. Your voice comes out funny. Like when you try to talk, you don't quite know words. They kind of disappear. It takes a while to sort of get back into the groove of it. And so I spent all of that time alone, but the way that I saw it, that I was listening to my best friend, who's the Buddha. Mm-hmm. And so I had like all of these letters from my best friend, who was speaking to me every day, and I had the very delightful and very special opportunity to listen to what my good friend was saying to me, and to try to really understand it. And so when you're doing that translation, you know, I had all of the resources of like dictionaries and grammars and all of these kinds of things to help me, and I had different friends that I could email. I would email Ajahn Brahmali or different scholars and things around the world whenever I came up to problems and all of these kinds of things. But the main process is really just to try to listen, what are these words saying? And to try to hear that voice, or that voice which ultimately comes from the Buddha, right? And sometimes it would be very difficult. Sometimes it might spend like a whole day or 2 days just with one word, right? Back and forth means this, it means that, and then going and researching, and then this scholar says this and that scholar says that, and trying to find an answer. And then at the end of the day, it's uncertain. But this is one of the things that my good friend Ajahn Brahmali told me or advised me when we were discussing about translations. And I always remember this point that he made. He said that there may be many things that are uncertain when we're dealing with Buddhist scriptures and these kinds of things. But there's one thing that we can say with a lot of confidence, and that is that the Buddha meant something. Right? He was saying something. He wasn't just speaking nonsense. Right? And once we've accepted that, that's actually a very powerful principle. Right? Because when we're reading the suttas, we know that, this has to mean something. And so whenever we come up with problems and areas that are uncertain and areas where we're not quite sure what it means, it's our job as translators to make the hard choice. Right? And we have to say, it means this and not that. We might be wrong, right? We're not arrogant about it, but we have to use our best judgment and to say, at the end of the day, we think that this phrase means this and it doesn't mean that, and we have to do it. And I thought when I was doing this, it occurred to me that the process of translation was like killing Schrodinger's cat. Do you know about Schrodinger's cat?
Oh, yeah.
Yes? No? Yes? Some people do. Some people don't. I'm shocked. What do they teach people at school these days? They don't teach them about Schrodinger's cat. I genuinely am shocked. I actually asked this question first when I was in Singapore a few weeks ago. And there's the same thing. Most of the people are like, Schrodinger's cat? No, what? Okay, well, I'll tell you about Schrodinger's cat. So, of course, you know about Schrodinger, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, Schrodinger was a physicist who was one of the founders of quantum physics. And if you know a little bit about quantum theory, you'll know that one of the great paradoxes of quantum theory is that what we think of as a particle sometimes behaves more like a wave and sometimes more like a particle. And so this is, it's a paradox, because normally we think something's either got to be a wave, it's kind of moving and smeared out and vague and fuzzy, or else it's a particle, it's well-defined and solid. But sometimes if you look at things like photons and so on, sometimes if you ask them certain questions, they'll answer as if they're a wave, and if you ask them other questions, they'll answer as if they're a particle. And so it's a bit an indeterminate kind of nature. So Schrodinger did this thought experiment where he imagined that a cat was like this. So, full disclaimer, no cats were harmed in this thought experiment, okay? Purely a theoretical idea, right? No cats involved. So you have a cat that is in this kind of state where it's ambiguous. Is it a wave or is it a particle? Is it alive or is it dead? Yeah? And this cat's in a box. And you've got no way of knowing whether the cat's alive or dead without opening the box. Because yeah? The cat knows, but the cat can't communicate that from inside the box. So it can't tell you. So it's a very kind of weird state. So he was using this as an idea to explore the paradoxes of this particular situation. And so the idea when you open the box and the cat is dead and you don't know whether you killed it or not. So this is what I felt like the job of translation was like. Like every time that every word has all of these potential meanings, right? There's so much richness in language, right? Different implications that we can draw out in one way and draw out in the other way. And yet somehow I've got to kill it. I've got to open the box and kill Schrodinger's cat every time I'm translating. I've got to say, no, it means this one, not that one. So it's very stressful in that way, right? So you have to make all these decisions, and you have to look at the end of the day and say, is this what that statement, is this what the Buddha was trying to convey? And so you have to try to train yourself to disappear, you know, through the process of translation. It's a process of disappearing, right? It's not my words, it's the Buddha's words. How would the Buddha express that if he was here? So this is that process of kind of trying to convey this translation. And one of the principles that I kept in mind was this idea that the Buddha taught for everyone, for all sentient beings, on this planet or on others. If we do get the Klingon translation, we'll be ready for them. Like I'm doing a translation into English, but what English do I translate it into? All right? Now, currently, the largest English-speaking nation in the world is China.
What?
Yeah, more people speak English in China than anywhere else.
What kind of English is that?
Chinglish.
Chinglish.
They speak Chinglish, okay? Right. Chinglish is statistically the main form of English on the planet Earth, right? Mm. English, as spoken by English people, right, is some kind of obscure, far-flung dialect that's virtually vanishing, right? The main dialect of English is Chinglish, numerically, right? So it's difficult for us to wrap our heads around this. Of course, most Chinese people don't speak English all that well, right? They learn it in school and stuff like that, but still, they still learn it. When we publish our suttas, and we can look at the usage of them. Now, if we look, for example, in Thailand, and if anyone's been in Thailand, lived in Thailand, you know that the standards of English in Thailand are not great, right? But more people in Thailand read the suttas in English than read them in Thai. Okay? That's curious, isn't it? Why is that? And so we ask our Thai friends, why is that? And they say, why do you read the suttas in English? They say, because it's easier to understand.
Yeah.
And so the translations, there are translations into Thai, but the translations are very formal, they're very archaic, they're very difficult. So much so that it's actually easier for many Thai people to read them in English. And my Sri Lankan friends say the same thing. Recently met a very senior Sri Lankan monk. He said the same thing. He would read the suttas in Pali, and when he can't understand the Pali, he'll consult the English translation rather than the Sri Lankan translation. So this is the case in many of the different translations, that they're quite hard to read. So I wanted to make a translation that would be in plain English. So it doesn't mean by like dumbing down the translation, but it just means not making it harder than it needs to be. And I wanted to make it so that people who speak English as a second language could read it and understand it. And I wanted to make it so that people who perhaps don't have a higher education can read it and understand it. So I didn't want... In many cases, translations have been done by linguists, for linguists or by philosophers, right? And so they're sort of pitched to that kind of quite high level, and they assume that kind of high level of education and English knowledge. So I wanted to try to make it available for everybody to read. This was the aim of my translation. So,
where did you find all the sutras that you translated?
So the suttas, the basis of the suttas that we use is from the text that we have on our website, Sutta Central. And so we've already collected all of the original language scriptures on that site.
Where did you get the original ones from?
Where did we get them from? Well, that's then a complicated story which goes back 2,500 years. But basically, we got our text from an organization in Bangkok called the Dhamma Society, who had created a digital edition of the Pali text, the Pali Tripitaka. They had sourced theirs from the Goenka organization, Vipassana Research Institute, and they had sourced theirs from the Sixth Council edition, which was made in Myanmar in the late 1950s. So that that's where this particular textual tradition comes from. That Sixth Council edition was derived from a Fifth Council edition made in Myanmar in the late 1900s, and which is inscribed on stone slabs in Myanmar. So that's and that previous to that had been passed down on palm leaf manuscripts. Yeah, but it's an interesting question because it's very complex, right? There are these different manuscripts passed down in different countries, Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand, and so on. And because the scriptures are so extensive, it's not easy to know to what extent they're similar or what extent they might be different. Yeah.
I was a police court interpreter for 9 years.
Really?
French, Italian, and Arabic, mostly French and Italian.
Okay.
So I didn't find it very difficult to translate at all because it's instantaneous. So I don't know where the difficulty is. If you know languages, you can immediately translate there and then. I don't know if it's a gift or I'm one of a million. I have no idea. But I did it for 9.5 years.
Ah, excellent. And then can we employ you to do that for us?
Anytime.
Especially the Arabic would be great. That's one we're really missing out.
Well, in Arabic, somehow I didn't very much emphasize. I don't know why. I resented the fact that women were insignificant and valueless, and I resented that because I think I'm of value, and I wanted to be like,
so.
I was born in an Arab country.
Okay.
And I've fought all along until I came to Australia, and then I found out, yes, I was worth more than what they were thinking that a woman should be worth. And as I said, I worked for the police for 9.5 years as a police court interpreter. And I found out it automatically comes a translation when you know the language. You don't have to stay long. I mean, the person was talking and I was talking at the same time while hearing her. So I don't think that there is any difficulties there.
Okay, so the question is how come... that's a very good question, by the way, because so many people have said to me, like, how come it took you did it so quickly? And now you're saying to me, how come it took you so long? So I think this is very good. But I think the difference really is that, if you compare, for example, say, writing with speaking, okay, so you just spoke that to me.
Yes.
And you didn't have to think about it. But what would happen if you tried to write an article saying the same thing?
Yeah.
That would be different.
And I know shorthand typing, so that's okay. That's
so doing written translations is a bit like that. So it's taking longer because of the written medium, and because you just have to be a lot more careful with a lot of things. So just as one example, in the Buddhist suttas, you find a lot of repetition. Right? So the Buddha might say the same phrase in one sutta, and then in another sutta, and then in another sutta. Now if we're just doing an off-the-cuff spoken interpretation, then that doesn't really matter too much as long as we convey the meaning. But if we're doing a written translation, we want to make sure that each of those contexts is translated consistently.
Yeah.
And that sounds like a simple thing, but there's a million words, and you have to keep on going over it again and again and again to ensure that those things are consistent. So this is really some of the difficulties of doing the written job as opposed to doing a spoken translation.
Yeah, I suppose it might be difficult for, I don't know, I mean, it most probably is a gift that I got, you know, because as you say, you know, it's not everybody that can do that.
But anyway, if you do want to do some Arabic for us, please let me know. We will be most
happy service.
That's good. Oh, it's so lovely to see, because you know, I'm sure you know that in Australia, it's very rare to find people who know more than one language. All right, so maybe that was just a bit of a background on my project and what I've been doing. We can discuss more later, but now it's time to do some meditation. Now, I should probably do a guided meditation, but I'm not going to. Bad luck. No, seriously, my throat is bad. So I had severe laryngitis last week, and I couldn't really speak. So we were doing talks, and I'd just be like, let's do some meditation. So I'm doing better now, but I can already feel that it's starting to wear out. Yeah. So is that okay? Do you mind if we just do some silent meditation today? Is that okay, rather than guided meditation? So sorry about that. Next time we'll do some guided meditation, right? So half an hour of silent meditation? Okay, thank you.
Nirang Sankupan Yasanati Upamakwachi Adhagamisami Nametakanka Evang Mandharehi Adhimuta Chitanti. Did everyone have a nice meditation?
Yes.
Good. Maybe for the last part of the session this evening, if there's any questions anyone would like to ask, then that would be good. Would you rather questions or a Dhamma talk? I don't.
Questions here, I think.
There are some questions here already, are there? Okay.
There's
a couple of questions here, which I'll begin with those, and then we'll see if anyone has any more. So actually, this is one of the characteristics of the Buddhist suttas that I've been translating as well. It's actually quite interesting to see that the Buddha would rarely sit down and just sort of talk, right? Yeah, he did do that sometimes, and especially for shorter teachings, but usually when it was something that was longer, it was almost always some kind of dialogue, some kind of question and answer. And I think that that's quite good. Like, we know that if you're listening in a lecture or something like that, that even if the lecturer might be really good, it's really hard to pay attention. So it's not actually a very very skillful way to teach. It's just to sit there and sort of go on and on and on. So the Buddha, most of the time, was engaging in dialogue. And another one of the interesting details in the suttas is that much of that dialogue was inter-religious dialogue. Right? So the Buddha wasn't just talking to Buddhists. In fact, he was very often talking to people who weren't Buddhists. Talking to people who are Brahmins. They had all these kind of movements in that time of India. They called the Samana movements. That they did all of these kind of, they had all these different kinds of beliefs and practices. Some of them believed in fatalism. Some of them believed in pure kind of determinism. They believed in all kinds of weird and wonderful things. Some people had no religious or spiritual beliefs at all. Some were skeptics. Some had never thought about these things, and so the Buddha was constantly meeting people from all different backgrounds and trying to engage them and to try to help them and to draw out their understanding. And it's very interesting to me to see that when the Buddha did that, he always treated people with respect. And this applies even to kids. And you know, one of the things that I've noticed as a Buddhist monk is that I quite often get like Buddhist families will come to me, and the parents will come and say, "Oh, you know, teach my children Buddhism." And I'll say, "Really? Teach your children Buddhism?" And I remember how the Buddha taught children Buddhism. And there was one time when he was walking into the village, and he came by a group of kids who were playing with a crab in a pond. And kids being a bit cruel sometimes, they were doing what kids do today, pulling the crab out and pulling its legs off, just to have some fun. And so the Buddha just
The Buddha didn't say, knock it off, kids, right? The Buddha didn't say, get out of here, give them a slap. No. The Buddha engaged with them and started talking to them. He said, what are you doing, children? I said, we're playing with this crab, pulling it out of the water and pulling its legs off. And said, oh, really? Would you like it if somebody did that to you? Would you like it if somebody pulled your legs off? Oh, no, we wouldn't like it. It would really hurt, yeah? But do you think that crab feels pain? Do you think that that suffers? Well, I don't know. Yeah, it looks like it's suffering. And so, rather than trying to enforce his ideas on them, even for the children, the Buddha was trying to waken up that understanding that they had in themselves. They knew, right? They knew, but they just hadn't put two and two together, right? They knew that these creatures are suffering. They knew that there was something wrong with it. And so the Buddha drew out that knowledge. And so this is what I do when the Buddhist families ask me to teach their kids. You know, I do something similar to that, you know, to sort of try to discuss with the kids and bring out some of their ethical ideas and so on. And then I say to the parents that they already understand Buddhism. Yeah? So it's not a matter of us trying to force that knowledge on them. It's a matter of trying to get people to see what wisdom that they have inside themselves. This is a much, much better way of approaching things. Alright, so somebody has said, they're curious whether I have any plan to renounce Sutta Central, so the Sutta website that I'm working on. They want to know whether I'm ready to renounce it, and whether, if so, when. No, I don't have any plans to renounce it, and if I did renounce it, I would do it if I wanted to, I guess, and do it if somebody was willing to take it over and run it. But actually, even that's not really necessary, because the way that we built the site, everything is open source. So, you know, there's other Buddhist text sites and so on and so forth in the past, and we've taken over their data and used their information and their text, and people will be able to do that with our site in the future. So that's not particularly a problem as far as I'm concerned. If someday we decide that we don't need to do it anymore, then we'll let it go. That's all right. But honestly, the main reason that I do it, apart from the fact that I enjoy it, is because nobody else is. There's nobody else really doing good sites for the suttas, and so that's where we kind of stepped in to try to do that. But if somebody else with more resources, more skills than us, because we're just a small team of amateurs, we're just a team of friends who get together and try to do the best we can, you know? And so if somebody can do it better than us, great. Okay, so here's just a few suggestions here. These are more kind of general suggestions rather than specific questions. So I might just leave them aside for one moment. Another one, this one, the five hindrances, is also quite general. But a couple of them mentioned about the five hindrances, so people want to know what about the five hindrances are. Does anybody know what the five hindrances are? Right. What?
Wanting, not wanting.
Wanting and not wanting?
Yep. Boredom, restlessness, and doubt.
Okay, that's pretty good, yeah, so that's five. So the first one is desire or wanting. So it's when you're sitting in meditation and you start thinking about things that you want. It might be food, it might be sex, it might be... Often it's just like comfort, right? Or it might be, you know, you want to watch your telly show or whatever it might be. And all of these images or ideas about things that you want start coming up in your meditation. Then things that you're averse to, right? Things you get angry and annoyed about, right? So often... the things that we're angry about are the things that get in the way of what we want, right? Yeah, so that we want to be able to get something, and whatever it is that stops us from getting there. And it's amazing how quickly that can be triggered, especially these days. We get very used to the idea. The more that we get used to the idea that we can have whatever we want when we want it, then the easier it is. You know, we've all kind of seen that when you want to do something on the web and it doesn't work and you get frustrated very quickly, or if you want to, you know, you're driving your car and then you get stuck in behind somebody and you can get very angry very quickly. So this is where that anger and aversion comes. And in meditation that can come up a lot, and in many different forms. So these five hindrances that the Buddha said are the primary obstacles to meditation. They can come up in many different forms, sometimes small, trivial ones, sometimes very big ones, right? And what tends to happen in meditation is that when you begin to meditate, they initially come up in very kind of trivial things, right? Things that maybe you think aren't that important. But then as you go deeper into your meditation, maybe you think you've let go of that, right? So it might be like, you know, a typical example might be, you know, you're say with anger, you might be like, oh, you got angry with somebody at work today, and when you sit down in meditation and then that anger flares up and you feel annoyed about that person, and that's an obstruction for your meditation. And then later on you can sit and you can learn to let go of that anger, and so you feel more peaceful. So that's good, right? But then you think, oh, I've let go of that anger, right? Ah, I've let go of that anger. And you have, it's true, right? But also, there's some conceit that slips in. There's some pride. Oh, I've let go of the anger. Yeah, right? Ah, I let go of the anger. Actually, these things are just conditions. You don't have to do anything. They will come and go just ordinarily, just like nature. It's just like the weather. It just comes and goes. The anger will pass away. But as your mind drops down deeper into deeper stillness, then maybe all of a sudden you come up with something that's much deeper. Yeah? And that kind of anger might be something even, you know, like maybe you're like really angry with your father. Right? Or something like that might come up very deep in your psyche. And you thought that you'd let go of that years ago, and suddenly that can come up again. So these things keep on recurring again and again and again. And so greed, anger, boredom or sloth and torpor, we translated tiredness and laziness. So tiredness and laziness has both like a physical and a mental dimension, right? I mean, sometimes obviously we're just tired physically, and that's just how it is. We need to do some sleep. But what's more more relevant from meditation is a kind of mental laziness. And what that comes from is from we condition ourselves that, like, if things are too much, right, we just want to shut down, right? You want to kind of insulate yourself from pain, right? And this is of course what drives a lot of things like drug taking and things like that, right? It's just a bit too much, so I just, you know, smoke a joint or have a drink or take a pill, and you kind of dull your experience, you dull your consciousness, and it works. It's okay, right? You get home from work and you're a bit frazzled and so on, and so you have a drink and you feel more relaxed. It's okay, right? It's quite a successful way of doing that, right? But it doesn't help you in the long term. It's just a short term bit of relief. So what we do in meditation is we learn to open up to those things and open up to that pain and not to back away from it. But your mind is very tricky, and so what your mind will do is your mind will kind of start to switch itself off, so it doesn't have to experience things. And when you start to become peaceful in your meditation, you'll be like peaceful, restless, right? And then you'll be like, ah, peaceful, ooh, asleep. Yeah. And that's often how it goes, right? So finding that kind of middle spot, that sweet spot between being restless and being sleepy. This is one of the great tricks in meditation. There's no secret to it, right? There's nothing you can do, but what you have to do is just learn to do it again and again and again, and you train yourself to notice it. But one of the tricks with noticing sloth and torpor, noticing tiredness in meditation, is that is to catch it early, because you find that your mind starts to switch off. All right, lights are just going a bit dim, and if you leave it too late, because it's quite pleasant. Right? So if you leave it too late, then you can't get out, right? You're already gone. Yeah. Yeah. It's alright, it's not a big problem, it's not something to worry about, right? Maybe you just go drowsy for a while or fall asleep for a while, it's okay, right? You're not hurting anyone. But it just means that your meditation's not going to go deeper because you don't have the brightness in your mind. So when you start to feel that mind sort of switching off, right? Just wake yourself up a little bit, even like open up your eyes or just, you know, make sure that you're feeling bright. Make sure your mind doesn't let that go deeper. So go into that tiredness. So that's the tiredness, and then restlessness, right? And so restlessness is like the almost like the the first thing that people notice when they start to meditate, right? It's the number one thing. People say, "Oh, I tried to meditate, but I'm not any good at meditating. I just think about things all the time," right? And so we want our mind to be still, but in fact our mind is restless. So what do we do about this? Right? How do we solve the problem of restlessness? Right? Well, you solve the problem of restlessness by not worrying about it. Because when you worry about it, you're becoming more restless. Okay? And so this is the little simile that I give for this, how to solve restlessness in meditation. So there's one man walking along the path and he comes to a pond. Right? And in the pond is another man who's jumping around in the pond and like hitting the surface of the water and pushing down on the surface of the water. And the first man says to the second man, "What are you doing?" It's strange, right? Why is he jumping around in the pond and pressing down the water? He says, "Well, I'm trying to get all the mud out of the water. See, the water in the pond water is muddy, and I'm trying to push all the mud down to the bottom because the mud should be at the bottom. I want the pond to be clear." And he says, okay, that makes sense now, right? Yeah. So this man's jumping around in the pond, pushing the mud down to the bottom of the pond. And obviously, as you're all wise and sensible people, you know that the more he jumps around, the more he stirs up the mud. So the other man says, well, he's not going to try to convince this guy that he's got the wrong method. So instead he says, well, look, here's something that you can do that might be able to help you to push the mud down to the bottom of the pond. He says, all right. And he says, okay, so I need you to get some things for me. I need you to get some pieces of wood, hammer and nails. I need you to get some firewood. We get a kettle, we get some water. So he made all these instructions, so he got these things, and then he got him working, hammering, and they built a little pagoda, a seat, a little shelter. They lit a fire, boiled a kettle, and made a cup of tea. And then they sat down on the seat. And by the time they sat down on the seat, the pond was perfectly clear. So that's what a meditation method is. Right? A meditation method is something that will distract you from your meditation long enough to allow your mind to become peaceful. Yeah. Right? So don't think that your meditation method is making your mind become peaceful. Your mind will naturally become peaceful. Just like that pond will naturally become still. But because we're so restless and we're so busy and we need something to do, we say, okay, we'll give you something to do to keep you distracted, right? Keep you occupied, let your mind become still. That's what a meditation method is. Yeah? Right, so you just do your meditation method. Don't worry about it too much. Just keep on coming back to your breath, if you're doing the breath, or whatever meditation you're doing, it doesn't matter too much. But usually we choose something to meditate on that's peaceful and something that's reassuring or uplifting, and then you meditate on that. And then I'm sure you've probably had this experience, like that man who turned around and suddenly realized that the pond was suddenly still. And meditation can be like that, can't it? And sometimes I feel like I've just been sitting here and thinking about things. And I turn around and realize, oh no, actually, suddenly my mind is peaceful and I didn't even notice it. Right? How did that happen? Why did my mind become peaceful? It's the nature of things to become peaceful. It takes energy to make them disturbed. Right? Thoughts aren't something that happen to you. Thoughts are something that you do. Yeah? And it's actually easier to not think than it is to think. Much easier. In fact, you've all done it many times while we're just sitting here. You've all stopped thinking. You think, oh, it's hard to stop thinking in meditation. But you've done it so many times already. The hard part is to not start. Stopping thinking is easy. The hard part is to not start thinking. Right? Because normally you stop thinking and then you get a bit bored and then you start again. Yeah? So to stop thinking and to just be peaceful with that. Yeah? And that's why we learn to enjoy the meditation. So the restlessness, and then the last one is the doubt. Okay. Now doubt is a subtle one, because doubt, there are actually quite good and wholesome forms of doubt, right? So the Buddha wasn't somebody who said that you should never doubt about things. On the contrary, there were many times when people would come to the Buddha and say, we're doubting about this question, and the Buddha would say, yes, that's a doubtful matter. He wouldn't say, don't doubt them. For example, they might come and say, oh, we've had these different spiritual teachers come along and teach these different things and we're not sure which is right. And the Buddha said, yes, you're quite right to doubt. It's a doubtful thing. Right? So doubt in and of itself isn't something that's bad or that's wrong. But there are certain kinds of doubt which, when you're meditating, are going to be an obstruction to you. Right? And so, you know, again, you think about this, that doubt has a valid role if you want to achieve something or want to accomplish some kind of task. Even just you think of something simple, like maybe you want to bake a cake, for example, and you might be thinking, what kind of cake is going to be good? We've got somebody's birthday party coming up. Should I do a carrot cake? Should I do a chocolate cake? Should I do a fruit cake? And you can be doubting, oh, I don't know, do they really like fruitcake and so on? Can I ask somebody about it? And so you can have doubts about it, and that's okay. It's reasonable to have those doubts at that point. But then you make a decision, and you start baking your cake. And if you're halfway through making a carrot cake, and you think, no, it should be a chocolate cake, and I'll put all chocolate in instead, and then halfway through that, you think, no, it should be a fruitcake, and I'll put fruit in instead, then you're going to end up with a big mess. I don't know, maybe it'll taste good anyway, right? So there's a doubt has a place, but once you've started to meditate, right? Once you're actually sitting there and meditating, doubt doesn't have a place there. Okay? So don't be sitting there and thinking, oh, is this the right way to meditate? Maybe I should try that other method. Maybe I need to listen to another podcast to find the right way to practice. So and so said that I did this meditation and it went really well. Maybe I should do that. Huh? Maybe I should get an app that can do a meditation for me, that'll make it like really easy, you know? Maybe I actually shouldn't be meditating at all, you know? Maybe it's just a waste of time. What's on Netflix? So it can be so many different kinds of doubts that are going to come up. So when you begin the meditation, it's really important that you have a clarity of purpose in your meditation. At that moment that you sit there and you think, okay, for this next 20 minutes, this next half an hour, I'm going to meditate, I'm going to watch the breath. And you'd be really clear about that. Yeah? And so if you want to try something else another time, that's fine. But for this period, this is what I'm going to do. And then you know during that meditation, when your mind drifts off and does something else, no, this is what I'm doing at this time. And you keep on coming back. So you train yourself to have that decision and to have that confidence during that period of meditation. So this is that hindrance of doubt. So again, just to repeat them, 5 hindrances. Desire or wanting things, hatred or aversion, wanting to get rid of things, tiredness and laziness, restlessness and remorse, and the last one is doubt. So these are the 5 primary obstacles to meditation. Okay, and they are things that will come up again and again and again. And just when you think that you've got over it, then it will come back in more subtle forms. But one thing also that's interesting in meditation is that subtle doesn't mean weak. This is also interesting. Because what we might think is, for example, if we do some loving kindness meditation, that we're going to weaken anger. Right? So we might think, oh yes, we'll get some anger might come up, but it'll be weaker and weaker forms. Right? But that's not quite how the mind works. The mind is a little bit sneakier than that. Right? And what you can find is that sometimes you can get this raging fury comes up and you think that you've been doing loving kindness meditation, that you're full of love for everyone, and then you can just turn a corner and then, oh, this anger comes, it's so strong. Yeah. The mind is very, very tricky, and these hindrances will always sort of turn around and they'll come in, they'll sneak in the back door and they'll find a new way. So you should become good friends with them. Don't think of these hindrances as enemies, okay? Don't think of them as something that you need to get rid of, okay? They are your friends, or your family, right? And I believe in a previous talk I talked about Aunt Sally in here. Does anyone remember Aunt Sally? No one remembers Aunt Sally, okay? But like a family member, right? You know, you might be maybe a family member like poor old Aunt Sally, who nobody really likes. And she's like really annoying, but she's there, you know, and it's okay, she's alright, you know. So you can still, because these hindrances are part of who you are. Right? They're like family. You can't disown them. Well, you can disown family, but you can't disown your own mind. So these things are part of who you are. Don't think of them. If you think of it as an enemy, then you're thinking of your own mind as an enemy. If you're thinking of it as something to get rid of, then you're thinking of your own mind as being something that you have to get rid of. So they're just parts of yourself. That's all right. It's just part of who you are. It's okay. Everyone has greed sometimes. Everyone has anger sometimes. Everyone's lazy sometimes. Everyone's restless sometimes. Everyone has doubt sometimes. It's a natural part of how the mind works. But we just learn to understand that those parts of our mind will prevent our meditation from going deeper, and they'll prevent our mind from becoming peaceful. So we learn how to let go of them, and we learn how to develop the mind so as we can go beyond those things. So this is a little bit of a talk today on the five hindrances, and I do believe that we have now run out of time pretty much. So unless anyone has a quick question.
No, that can't be wrong. It's terribly fast.
How fast exactly?
Great doubt. Great doubt.
Well, now I am doubting. You know, that can be a bad problem for us, because you know we have to finish eating before 12. Right, so that's one of the things, is we only eat in the morning. So I remember one time when I was in Bangkok and I was eating with a monk who was my teacher, but we were eating and the people were bringing food and they were talking and they were doing chanting. It was tick 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 tick, 10 to 12, 5 to 12. Oh my goodness. Anyway, so finally we could start eating, and I only had 5 minutes, so I just ate a little bit and then had to stop. And then someone came up and said, "Oh, don't worry, the clock's fast. Yeah, you've got another 20 minutes." Oh, thank you very much. You could have mentioned that before. Anyway, I think that's good. Yeah, we're good, yeah? Announcements.
Thank you very much, Bhante, for your time tonight. On behalf of the group, I hope we can see you again one day in your travels.
Next week.
Yeah. Next week?
Next week I'll be in.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you.